Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All lines will be in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of the call, at which time you may ask a question by pressing star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Vivian White. Thank you. You may begin.
Thanks so much. Good evening, and welcome to everybody with us here online tonight. Our teleconference tonight is all about our favorite star, the sun. And this summer really puts the sun on center stage with some high sunspot activity, an eclipse for those of us on the West Coast, and a Venus transit for everybody here across the U.S. Before I go any further, let's take a minute to introduce ourselves and make sure you're all set up. I'm Vivian White, and Night Sky Network diva Marnie Berenson's also here with us, just back from NEAF in New York. Hi, Marnie. How was it?
Hi, everybody. Yeah, well, it was really wonderful to have the chance to meet so many of the Night Sky Network members there. We did want to let you know that we will be in Alcon in Chicago, so I hope to see more of you there.
Oh, great. And we've also got Jessica Santoscoy, our tech guru here. Jessica, what do you know? Hi.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here also. And it's also wonderful to see all of your events posted on the NSN calendar. And I just want to remind you, when you post to the NSN calendar, they show up on Go Stargaze and Distant Suns. So keep posting. We're loving it and getting that publicity out for you.
Yeah, those are two apps that are the Distant Suns is a really popular app of a planetarium program, correct?
That's right. Yeah, with Distant Suns, you can see the sky and use it as a sky map. And so that goes a little further, and if you click on events on that app, you can see the Night Sky Network events. It's really, really nice.
Cool. So for those of you who don't already know us, we're based here in San Francisco at the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, where we administer the Night Sky Network program, including telecons like these. So now for a few technical notes before we get started. If you don't have the PowerPoint slides up in front of you, you can just go to this website, www.astrosociety.org/NSN Telecon. That's astrosociety.org/NSN Telecon. And if you have any questions along the way, feel free to email us. We're monitoring our email tonight at nightskyinfo@astrosociety.org. So now, operator, if we could open up the lines, we'd like to hear from all of you out there. Please just tell us your name and which club you're a part of.
Big Steve Ramson, Charlie Bates, Solo Astronomy Project. Big Steven Ramson.
Barb Geigel, Berks Astronomy, Reading, Pennsylvania.
All right. Hi, Barb.
Hi.
Darian O'Brien, the Darian O'Brien Astronomy Club in Lakewood, Colorado. Thanks, Vivian, for your help today.
Oh, thanks, Darian. Good to hear from you.
Sarah Ramos, Charlie Elliott, Chapel Field Planet Astronomy Club.
Stuart Myers, Amateur Astronomers in New Jersey.
Dick Grossi with the Lake County Astronomy Society in northwest of Chicago.
Harry Thiemann, Rockford Amateur Astronomers, Rockford, Illinois.
Jed Knight, Birmingham Astronomical Society of Alabama.
Sue Rose, Amateur Observer Society of New York.
Hi, everybody. This is Linda Prince from the Amateur Observer Society of New York.
And Linda, too.
Nancy Grace Roman, National Capital Astronomers.
Hi, Nancy Grace.
Oh. Marie Lott of the Two Charlies in Atlanta.
Art Zorka from the Atlanta Astronomy Club.
Dan Wade from the Warren Rupp Observatory, Mansfield, Ohio.
This is Michael Forster. I'm with Astronomy.fm, and we'll be broadcasting this on Astronomy.fm later.
Great. Thanks.
Will I come in there?
Lee Green with the Twin City Amateur Astronomers in Normal, Illinois.
Normal.
All right. Anybody else out there want to say hello?
Angela Mastercola, Berks Astronomy Club.
Great. Grace Wyatt, Harford County Astronomical Society, Bel Air, Maryland.
Russ Drum, Star Astronomy in New Jersey.
Jay Miller, National Capital Astronomers, Maryland.
James Williams, East Central Minnesota Astronomy Club.
Jim Small and John Beery from St. Louis Astronomical Society.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Billy.
St. Louis Astronomical Society.
Bruce Aples from the Fox Valley Astronomical Society.
Great. Okay.
Hi,
well,
John Haisley, Iowa County Astronomers in Wisconsin.
Excellent. Let's go ahead and close the lines up and get started.
Always great to hear from everybody. Thanks.
The lines are now closed.
All right. Thank you. I hear a lot of familiar names and a lot of new, not faces, I don't see you, but a lot of new names out there. Congrats. We're happy to have you here. I also heard there was at least one person from the Charlie Bates Solar Astronomy Project out there, and I wanted to just give a big shout-out, thank you, to this great club who has donated solar viewing glasses in all of the new magnetic sun toolkits. Okay, we really appreciate that. So speaking of which, in addition to this teleconference about the sun, many of you are going to be receiving our newest outreach toolkit called Our Magnetic Sun in the next week or so. It is packed with models and demos to use at the telescope, also activities that are fun in large or small groups. There is a gorgeous banner, if I do say so myself. It wasn't me. It was Marnie mostly. But there's a gorgeous banner that's being shipped in a separate tube. So keep an eye out for both of those packages on their way to your club in the next week if you qualified. And I should mention that the presentation tonight was the inspiration for the PowerPoint that's included in the solar toolkit. So you may glean some talking points from this presentation to use in your solar outreach this summer. So let me introduce you to our speaker now. Dr. Brian Mendez is an astronomer as well as an education specialist at the Science... Let me start that over. Dr. Brian Mendez is an astronomer as well as an education specialist at the Center for Science Education at UC Berkeley Space Science Labs. There, he develops programs for the public and for use in schools and also conducts professional development workshops for science educators. Dr. Mendez received his Ph.D. in astrophysics from UC Berkeley. But lest you think he's only got his head in the stars, he also told me that he has a BMA in saxophone performance. Now, that has to really help with workshop attendance, Brian. Do you know any solar songs?
Solar songs.
Sorry to put you on the spot there.
I'm sure there's some out there that have.
I sing You Are My Sunshine all the time. I like that one a lot. But it's probably a bit simple for your saxophone. Well, we're really glad to have you back with us tonight. And we are happy to get started whenever you are. Welcome.
Thank you, Vivian. And thank you, everybody. It's a pleasure, as always, to talk to the Night Sky Network. And I'm going to be telling you about the sun today. This is one of my favorite topics. I work on a lot of different education programs for NASA missions, and several of those are missions that study the sun. So it's always fun to be able to point out, you know, one of our closest astronomical objects. I guess full disclosure, when I started working at Space Sciences Laboratory, I had come from doing research in extragalactic astronomy. And when I found out that I was going to be working on projects that studied the sun, I was like, the sun? That's not astronomy. It's so close. But come to love it. So I'm going to go ahead and get started with the slideshow, and I'm going to go ahead and move on to off the title slide onto slide 2 and ask the first question, what is the sun? And, you know, you're definitely a lot of the people coming to your events will ask this kind of question. And the first answer that you might give might, in fact, be quite a shock to some of them who've just never really thought about it. The sun is a star. And people, of course, the sun is a star, but the stars are these, you know, dim little things that we see at night. But, of course, it's a star that we see very close up. However, when you answer the sun is a star, that begs the question, well, then what are stars? So that's the other part of the slide here, which is a bit of a explanation then on what a star is, a giant ball of hot, ionized, mostly hydrogen gas that makes its own light. All right. Moving on to slide 3. It's, I think, useful to point out what the star is not. It's a very, very common to hear that the sun is an average yellow star. And I'm here to tell you folks that it is neither. Let's look at slide 4. First of all, the sun's color is not yellow. It is white. If you've ever tried to look at it, you can attest to that fact. It's just a blinding white thing. However, you will notice that if you look at it when it's rising or setting, it does kind of take on a more orangey or yellowish color, and that's because of atmospheric scattering. It scatters more of the blues out of the spectrum, so you end up with more of the reds. But at noontime, you're staring at the sun, it's white. And there's actually a picture that I took in Mexico about a year ago during solar zenith passage. So when the sun was directly overhead, there's a picture of it in the upper left corner there. It's blinding white. If you take a spectrum of the sun in the upper right corner, you see that you can see all the colors of the rainbow in the spectrum of the sun. If the sun were yellow in color, you would not see very many of the blues and greens, for example. Another example of the sun being white is just looking at it in projection. So, you know, a sunspotter is a really simple tool for projecting the sun's image down there in the lower right-hand corner. You can see the image of the sun coming through, and it's white. And then another thing for the people who just don't want to believe it, think about, you know, a white T-shirt. If you were to wear a white T-shirt under a yellow sun, it would look yellow. But when you go outside in a nice white T-shirt, it looks white. And then, of course, there's always our little disclaimer. Don't stare directly at the sun. Though you can do a quick glance, and it won't hurt. All right, moving on to slide 5. There's that other part about the sun being average that I wanted to just point out. The sun is not really average by any measure that you can really think of. Most of the stars in the universe are much cooler and dimmer and smaller in size than the sun. So by any of the measures like, you know, size, temperature, mass, any of those things, the sun is actually kind of above the average. It's not even middle-sized or anything like that. There are definitely many stars that are much, much bigger, more massive, more luminous than the sun. However, there are relatively few of those stars compared to the number of stars that are smaller, cooler, less luminous. Really, the sun is a above-average white star, as I think you might better characterize it. All right, moving on to slide number 6. A little bit about how big it is and how far it is from us. The actual size of the sun is enormous. It's 109 times the diameter of Earth, which means you could fit over 1 million Earths inside the sun. That's a lot. But that's kind of counterintuitive to the way we view the sun on a daily basis. The picture in the lower right shows the sun setting over the Golden Gate Bridge, seen here in the Bay Area. And, you know, if you're just looking at it, the sun appears to be smaller than the Golden Gate Bridge. So that's really strange. But that's because it's so far away. And a lot of people can kind of, once you kind of talk through that a little bit, it becomes easy for people to realize, oh, right, it's big, but it's really far away. And, you know, the actual numbers are there on the slide for you. It's 150 million kilometers. It's so far that it takes light 8 minutes to travel that distance. And, of course, astronomers like to make things simple, so they just define that distance between the Earth and the sun as an astronomical unit. All right, so moving on to slide 7, and just do a quick reminder about the spectrum of light. I showed in that previous slide the spectrum of the sun and its visible spectrum. It's the light that your eyes can see, but there's a lot more than your eyes can see. Light comes in forms like low-energy, long-wavelength radio all the way through high-energy, short-wavelength gamma rays. And it turns out that if we examine the sun in all these different wavelengths, we can sure learn a lot about it. So the next few slides are going to do that. So let's look at slide 8. Slide 8 is an image of the sun in visible light. And again, notice its color, white. I'll mention that if you're reading the words on this slide, there's a little boo-boo. I should have deleted some of the second part. This is it's actually referring to slides which would have preceded this in a different talk, but I changed the order of the slides. So there's a mystery that I sometimes open the talk with. Decided to take a different route this way. So anyway, if you're reading that and you're confused about the mysterious events just described, yeah, you didn't miss anything. but you know, one of the things to notice is the sun, when you look at it in visible light, is fairly featureless, except for these very dark spots on the face of it, which we simply called sunspots. But if we start looking around in other wavelengths at the sun, for example, in slide 9, we're looking at the sun. Actually, it's still visible light, but we've filtered out everything except for a very specific color of red, which comes from a special transition of electrons in the hydrogen atom, hydrogen alpha, which I'm sure most of you all have heard of. So you look at the sun in this, and you can still see those dark spots, but there starts to be a bit more detail revealed. You can see brighter spots, in fact, around the dark spots. You start to see this kind of mottled appearance to the overall sun, and then there's some strange features which you can see at the limbs of the sun, or sometimes they appear as like dark filaments running across the face, and they get named filaments. And we've learned that these most of these features are all due to magnetic activity on the sun. Let's look at slide 10. Slide 10 is going into ultraviolet light. So now we've gone beyond what you can see with your eyes into light that's very high energy, short wavelength. And what we're seeing is not the same part of the sun that we were looking at before. When we were looking in visible light, we were basically looking at what we call the sun's surface or its photosphere. When we go into ultraviolet light, we're actually kind of going out into its atmosphere above that, and we're seeing very, very hot gas that's so hot that it's all ionized, and it's trapped inside of magnetic fields, and it's tracing out those magnetic fields, just like iron filings do when you drop them around a magnet. That's the same thing that this hot gas is doing. It's tracing out the magnetic fields all around and above those sunspots. So I should point out that the previous two pictures, all of these pictures that you're seeing of the sun in these sequence of slides, are all on the same day. So this is all the same features, just in different wavelengths. So in fact, let's look at slide 11, which is another wavelength of ultraviolet, but this is a much higher energy even than the previous slide. And we're looking at even hotter gas, and we're now seeing that most of the material that we're seeing, in fact, at this level, is focused into those magnetic regions above the sunspots. And then in slide 12, I've actually created a little composite of all of the previous slides. So this is a composite of the visible images and the ultraviolet images to give you a sense of the overall structure from the sun's surface outward into its atmosphere, and you can see how those magnetic fields are associated right with those sunspots. So moving on to slide 13, the slide kind of steps you a little bit deeper into the sun to talk about its structure that's interior. We had just kind of seen some of its exterior features, but we have actually managed to learn about the interior of the sun. I won't go too much into it, but the method that we've used to determine the inside of the sun, it's kind of twofold. On the one hand, you kind of understand the basic physics of gravity and plasma and gas and pressure, and you put all that physics together and you build a model of the sun, and that model kind of tells you what the structure inside should be like. And then we actually use seismic waves that we can observe directly on the surface of the sun, and we can observe the way those waves are behaving on the surface and infer the materials that they pass through, just the way we've... So this is completely analogous to the way we've been able to determine the interior of Earth using seismic waves. We can do the same thing on the sun. In fact, the field is called helioseismology. And the beautiful thing about it is that you put the models together with the observations and you're able to understand a complete picture of the interior of the sun. So we know that the sun has a very dense core that is also obscenely hot. The temperature at the core of the sun is over 15 million kelvins, and kelvin is the absolute temperature scale. So that's ridiculous. And there's just nothing in like that anywhere else in the universe. The cores of stars are just crazy dense. They're so dense that the very small protons that would make up the nucleus of a hydrogen atom are able to get close enough to each other that they that instead of repelling, the strong nuclear force actually takes over and binds them together and forms a new atomic nucleus, a helium nucleus. And that is a reaction that actually releases energy. So that's the way the sun makes all of its energy. It converts hydrogen into helium. And it really can only do that because of the extreme temperature and pressure that you have right down there. I should say extreme temperature density and pressure that you have in the core. So all that energy is produced in the core, and then it makes its way out of the core, and it goes through a zone that we call it the radiative zone because that's how the energy is transported. It means it moves through radiation. So it's light energy that's carrying the energy from the core away from the core. And it actually takes a long time for that energy to diffuse its way out through this zone. We figure that it takes somewhere in the order of 10 to 100,000 years for light to actually transport the energy produced in the core out to the edge of the radiative zone. The temperatures set in the radiative zone are still pretty hot in the millions of degrees Kelvin. Then you go to a zone where energy transport takes on a different form. It becomes convection, and so we simply call that the convective zone, where you have giant cells of hot gas that rise up, they cool, and then they fall back down, get heated, rise up, cool, around and around and around. So that's good old convection for you. It's right at the top of the convection zone where you get the photosphere, the place where all of the visible light that we see from the sun comes from. And that's where we see the sunspots. And the temperature there has dropped significantly. It was millions of degrees Kelvin in the core, and now at the surface of the photosphere, it's about 5,800 degrees Kelvin. The sunspots being just a tad bit cooler, and that actually explains why they appear dark. Because even though they're a little bit cooler, intensity goes with temperature to the fourth power. So a small decrease or increase in temperature actually is a huge increase in brightness. If you could take just one sunspot and put it at the same distance away from Earth, it would be much brighter than the full moon, in fact. So sunspots are actually pretty bright. It's just that in comparison to the hotter gas around them, they appear dark. So it's really a matter of contrast when you're looking at the sunspots. Then above the photosphere is kind of a layer that where most of the ultraviolet light from the sun comes from. It's called the chromosphere. And it's also that part of the sun that you can see in hydrogen alpha in visible light. The temperature there, strangely enough, rises again. Instead of getting cooler, it's actually gotten hotter. However, the density drops off. So that means the actual heat content is less than deeper in the sun, but the temperature of the gas has gone up. It's kind of counterintuitive. And then the corona goes even further. It's the outer atmosphere of the sun that, in fact, extends all the way out through the solar system, and the temperature there of the gas is very, very hot. So it's, again, in the millions of Kelvin. But again, the density is extremely low, so the heat there is extremely low. You were just bathing in coronal material, you would freeze rather than cook. All right. That was a very content-heavy slide. And, of course, if you have questions about it, go ahead and ask me at that time at the end of the talk. I'm going to move on to slide 14. This is a kind of a fun composite picture of the sun that allows you to see the corona and the photosphere at the same time. What was done here was an image of the sun was superimposed over an image of the corona taken during a total eclipse of the sun by the moon. So that's humans have been seeing the corona of the sun for thousands and thousands of years. You know, ever since they first started observing solar eclipses, you can see the corona with your unaided eye, and that's pretty much the only time that can happen is when the moon directly blocks out the sun and allows you to see that beautiful corona around it. And you can even see some of the overall magnetic structure in the corona in this image. And that corona just keeps on going out through the solar system, and in fact, the planets are in it. Basically, that corona becomes what we call the solar wind. It starts moving away, blowing away from the sun, and in fact, it blows far enough out into past most of the planet, well, past all of the planets, and it kind of blows a bubble in space, if you will, that the boundary of this bubble is basically the place where the solar wind meets the interstellar dust and gas. And we've actually been able to measure the inner parts of this bubble now. The Voyager spacecraft have entered and passed through the kind of inner regions of this this bubble. So we sometimes refer to everything inside of this this bubble the heliosphere, so all the things that are the sphere of influence of the sun. And the distance out to that inner part of the bubble that the Voyagers have reached is about 100 times the distance between the Earth and the sun, so it's about 100 AU from the sun. All right, so going on to slide 16, let's come back down to the surface of the sun and look a little closer at those sunspots and those magnetic regions. Our understanding of the magnetism on the sun is that it's produced in that convective zone where all of the plasma is circulating, going up and down, up and down. That produces electric currents, and electric currents produce magnetic fields. And the magnetic fields can actually poke through the surface. And you've got that cartoon version of that in the left side of the image here on slide 16. And then on the right-hand image, you see, you know, the reality, which, of course, is much messier than the simplified cartoon version. But we see these magnetic field lines poking out of the surface of the sun. And basically the footprints of those loops are the sunspots. And like I said, the sunspots appear dark because they're a little bit cooler, and they're cooler because of the strong magnetic field. The magnetic field actually inhibits the convection in that part of the sun, which actually causes those parcels of gas to cool faster than the ones around them. All right, so moving on to slide 17. We've been observing the sun carefully now for over 400 years and counting up those sunspots as they occur, and notice that they come and go with some regularity. And in fact, if we plot out the number of sunspots with time, you see this graph up top, which starts about 1610 and goes through 2007, although we could probably, if I looked around, I could probably find one that comes all the way up to 2012. But you right away you notice that there's a pretty regular pattern. Every 11 years, there's an increase and decrease in the number of sunspots you see, with that strange period from about 50 years, from 1650 through 1700, where sunspots disappeared on the sun. There were no sunspots on the sun for that 50-year period. Kind of a strange time. And one of the astronomers at the time who had talked about that absence. His name was Maunder, and so they called it the Maunder Minimum. Well, our understanding of the solar cycle has been evolving over time, but our latest idea is that it has to do with the overall structure of the magnetic field of the sun and what happens to it with time. And the basic idea is this, and it's kind of illustrated in the cartoon. The idea is that the sun has initially a nice, simple dipole magnetic field that's kind of like, you know, the one that Earth has or the other planet, or many of the other planets have. But the sun is all fluid. It's a gas. And rotating fluid objects don't necessarily rotate all at the same rate. Like, you know, Earth is a big rock, so when you spin it, the whole thing spins at the same rate. But if you spin a liquid, the whole thing doesn't necessarily spin at the same rate. Think about, stirring coffee or something like that. When you stir, some parts of it will spin a lot faster than the other parts of it, and that's what happens on the sun. And, in fact, on the sun, its poles rotate slower than the equator. But because the sun is all made up of charged gas, it's all mostly ionized, the magnetic field lines are actually kind of stuck to the gas, so, such as the physics of magnetic fields and plasmas. So as that sun is kind of differentially rotating, parts of the magnetic field are getting twisted ahead of the other parts of it. And the idea is that basically after 11 years of this, every 11 years of this twisting, the sun has reached kind of the maximum amount of twist it can take. And the field actually kind of breaks and flips over. And so you actually get a reversal of the north and south magnetic poles on the sun every 11 years. And the maximum of sunspot activity happens when you have the most complicated and twisted field. And then when the field breaks and reforms with flipped polarity, it's then simple like a dipole again, and you have very few sunspots. So the sunspot minimums are when you have a nice, orderly solar magnetic field, and the sunspot maximums are when you have a very twisted and mangled solar magnetic field. All right, so moving on to slide 18. So one of the things that can happen when you get those twisted magnetic fields that are poking through the surface of the sun is that there can be a lot of motion within those magnetic fields themselves, and they can, in fact, erupt into solar flares. So the sequence of images you have here is actually from a movie that shows a solar flare in action. And one of the things I want to point out is that a solar flare is an event. Sometimes you'll hear people, and they'll point to one of the loops that I was showing you earlier that happened in the corona of the sun, and they'll call that a solar flare. But, you know, a loop can just be static, and it's not a solar flare. The flare is an event. It's an actual eruption in one of those loops. And as you can see, there's a lot of motion of gas. Gas will kind of erupt and move all around as the magnetic field basically goes through a big change in shape. And so these solar flares basically happen when one of those loops gets stretched or pulled in such a way that it can no longer contain all the energy within it, and it breaks and releases a bunch of energy and reforms into a simpler form. So that's the basic thing that's happening in a solar flare, is you're having the magnetic field rapidly evolving. So solar flares can happen over the order of minutes to an hour or so. And they are the biggest explosions in the solar system. There's nothing bigger in all the solar system. At the end of the talk, I have a chart that kind of compares the energy in a solar flare to other energetic events that you might be familiar with. So come back to that one. Let's look at another type of storm in the sun in slide 19. These are called coronal mass ejections. And the sequence of images here, what you're seeing is a section of a field of view taken by a satellite that's in space. I think this is from the SOHO spacecraft. And what's been done is the spacecraft is creating basically a little false eclipse. It has a little disk that it puts in front of the camera and occults the sun. So that's down in the lower right-hand corner of each of these images, you'll see that there's a little teeny circle. That's where the sun is located, and then there's this blue disk around it, and that's the disk that's blocking out the light of the sun. And what that allows you to do is see the structure in the corona around the sun. And this sequence of images is showing an eruption of matter out of the corona. So there's a whole bunch of mass, and it's basically like a big bubble that just starts growing and growing and growing, and then it like pops and just releases all of that material out into the solar system. And that is what we call a coronal mass ejection, literally an ejection of mass from the corona. It's kind of a mouthful, so the solar scientists just call it a CME. And I think in your kits that you'll be getting, it's just referred to as a solar storm. And the connection between CMEs and solar flares is kind of complicated. It's the case that you often will have the two of them occurring together, but you can also have a solar flare that has no coronal mass ejection, or you can have a coronal mass ejection where there was no solar flare. So they don't. One doesn't necessarily mean that the other occurred, but they often do occur together. The analogy that I like to make is that they're kind of like volcanoes and earthquakes. You know, sometimes you can get a volcanic eruption resulting from an earthquake. Sometimes you can get an earthquake resulting from a volcanic eruption, and sometimes they happen together. So I think that's kind of analogous to what we see happening with CMEs and solar flares. And I should say the energy comparison between a CME and a solar flare are pretty similar. They're about the same level of an energetic event. So moving on to slide 20, because you have looked at that image and seen that enormous amount of gas getting thrown into space and might have wondered, well, do they ever hit Earth? And here's a picture of a CME. It's actually a composite of three different views of the sun from the same spacecraft, all from SOHO. The green image of the sun is a camera that was looking directly at the sun in ultraviolet light. And then the red and blue are kind of two different fields of view with that occulting disk in front blocking out so they can see the corona around it. And this was a period back in 2003 where the sun was at maximum. Actually, it was just coming off of maximum, and it had some very violent storms for about a week and a half period. And what you notice in this picture is that there's this big kind of bubble around the sun that seems to be surrounding the entire thing. If you think about that for a minute, that is because we're looking straight down the barrel, basically, of a bubble that's erupting right at Earth. So indeed, sometimes these things are directed right at us. The material doesn't get to us right away, so we see the light, way before the material gets to us. Generally, most of the material in the CME will take a few days to get here, although there is a shock wave that accelerates particles to near the speed of light, and some of those get here just a few minutes after the light from the explosion gets here. But the bulk of the material takes a little bit longer. All right, so moving on to slide 21. So if we're going to try to understand what's going to happen to Earth when we get hit by those clouds, we first should kind of look at Earth's own magnetic environment to realize what's going on. So in slide 21, it's just kind of a simplified picture of the Earth's magnetic fields, where you can kind of imagine there's a big bar magnet inside Earth. Although the reality is that Earth's magnetic field is being generated by electric currents that are in the liquid iron core of the planet. And one of the things you might also notice, of course, is that the magnetic polarity of the planet is actually kind of opposite what you might have expected. The north magnetic pole is actually located in the geographic south of the planet. If you think about that for a moment, you can realize, well, if you have a compass, your compass has a little north pole, and it points north. But the way magnets work is that like poles repel and opposite poles attract. So if the north pole of your compass is being attracted to something in the north, it's being attracted to a magnetic south. and that's what we have. They do actually flip, and not with terrible regularity. On average, it's about 500,000 years. Every 500,000 years, you get a flip, but that's a very poor average because there have been periods of hundreds of millions of years with no flips, and then periods where it goes in a faster cadence. But the flips also don't occur very quickly. It takes thousands of years for the flip to occur. So it's not very much like the sun's flips. So slide 22, Earth's magnetic field, if we kind of zoom out from it a bit more, it starts to look less and less like that simplified bar magnet magnetic field because it's always interacting with the solar wind from the sun. So the sun's blowing out that wind of charged gas, and because it's charged gas, it interacts electromagnetically with our magnetic field and actually changes its shape. So what happens is on the day side of Earth, you get a compressed magnetic field, and on the night side of Earth, you get a kind of what's called a magnetotail. That side of the magnetic field is actually drawn out away from the Earth on the night side. And then in slide 23 is kind of a little more of a 3D rendering of what that magnetic field looks like. And one of the important things to realize about the magnetic field is that it actually deflects all of the solar wind particles around the Earth. It's a shield that stops all of that material and sends it around us so that really very little is getting in. There's only two special spots where any particles can directly enter Earth's magnetic field from the sun. Those are called the polar cusps, and they're on the day side of Earth, and they're pointed out in the slide with the arrows. So those are just a teeny part of the magnetic field where any solar particles can directly get into Earth's magnetic field. In fact, it's a common misconception that the aurora are caused by solar wind particles directly coming through the magnetic field to hit Earth, and that's actually not the case at all. They actually come from the magnetotail particles that already are inside Earth's magnetic field. Slide 24. All right, so now we'll talk about what happens when one of those CMEs hits Earth's magnetic field. So this is, again, a sequence of pictures from a movie, a nice NASA animation of what happens during what's called a geomagnetic storm when Earth is impacted by a CME. Basically, the cloud from the CME impacts the magnetic field. It compresses the north, the day side even more than it was already. And then it causes the night sides to stretch out so much that it then kind of like snaps, it breaks and snaps back like a rubber band and shoots material. It rings like a bell. The whole magnetic field kind of rings like a bell. And then it also accelerates particles from the tail back toward Earth, which actually end up causing they don't cause the aurora, but they actually cause the aurora to become more intense. The aurora are actually almost always happening, and this event intensifies the aurora. All right, so if we move to slide 25, we'll actually talk about some of the effects that can happen during a geomagnetic storm. So one of the things that can happen is a big blackout. So the two pictures shown here are actually actual pictures from 2003 when there was a blackout in the Toronto and Detroit and Cleveland area. This one wasn't because of a geomagnetic storm, but it's a good illustration of what a large-scale blackout can do. A actual blackout like this did occur in 1989, which was during a solar maximum. And what happens is that when the magnetic field of Earth is ringing like a bell and sending all of those extra particles into the atmosphere, causing the enhanced aurora, you get this sequence of induction that happens, electric and magnetic induction. So you have a magnetic field which is moving all around, and if you think back to your electromagnetic courses in college, maybe, you might remember that when a magnetic field moves, it makes an electric field. And then when an electric field moves, it makes a magnetic field. So what you have happening is the moving magnetic field of the Earth that's ringing like a bell generates this electric field that causes the current of particles that runs through the atmosphere, lights up the sky, causes the aurora. And then that current running through the atmosphere induces a big magnetic field near the ground, which then induces a big electric field right on the ground. And that huge electric field will push a ton of charge through electrical grids, and it can blow out transformers and cause large-scale blackouts. So we had one in the Ontario region back in 1989. In 2003, as a result of the storms that actually I showed you a few slides back on the sun, we had blackouts, I believe, in the Norway, Sweden area. So there were some blackouts actually that resulted because of that storm even more recently. One of the other effects then on slide 26 is there can be disruptions in communications. And this actually would happen not necessarily with the coronal mass ejection, but this can happen as a result of the solar flares. What happens is that a lot of our communications technology between satellites and the ground, or between the ground and aircraft, or between ground and watercraft out at sea, is that we use our atmosphere to bounce radio signals around, or we're passing radio signals through the atmosphere to communicate with satellites. And when a solar flare happens, it actually changes our atmosphere, because when a solar flare occurs, it sends out X-rays and gamma rays in huge amounts. And the sun is always sending out these X-rays, which keeps the day side of the planet's atmosphere ionized at the top. It's called the ionosphere. When a solar flare happens, the ionosphere gets deepened, and then which actually then changes the way in which radio waves will pass through it or bounce off it. So we often use the atmosphere as a way to bounce radio signals around the planet to communicate long distances with, say, aircraft or ships at sea. And then so we can have communications blackouts with as a result of that changed ionosphere. And then satellites, we might lose signal from them for a while as the signals are having difficulty passing through the changed ionosphere. And on slide 27, one of the results of that is that GPS signals especially can be affected by this, and you can end up being several meters off from where you intended to, where you thought you were as a result of your GPS. And the other thing that kind of happens is, because the magnetic field of the planet as a whole in a geomagnetic storm is moving around, the location of magnetic north can actually change for a few hours. So your compasses would actually point to a different spot. All right, and then on slide 28, one of the other effects is the enhanced aurora. They can be enhanced to the point where they can actually be seen fairly far south. And, in some of the more recent geomagnetic events, there have been aurora that have been sighted in the tropics, which is pretty exciting for people down there who normally would never get to see such a beautiful event. So on slide 29 is a bit of a summary of all of this stuff which we tend to call space weather. It's the effects that the sun can have on the Earth in space. So it's just like weather, and we're trying to actually be able to understand and predict it just like we do Earth-based weather. So it's, all this energy from the solar flares and CMEs can affect our technological and space-based technology especially. One of the things I didn't mention that's listed in this list here is that just for astronauts who are especially in flight paths that take them near the magnetic poles of the planet, where there's all that radiation that's coming down, they can be threatened by the amount of radiation. If they were outside of Earth's magnetic field, they could be definitely at risk from CME shockwave particles. Those things could be deadly. But inside Earth's magnetic field, they're protected. The last slide, slide 30, or I don't think it's the very last slide, but slide 30 is a chart of the energies that I wanted to just point out to you. There's kind of two columns here. One is energy listed in food calories. I did that just because I thought it might be interesting for people who are used to thinking about the amount of energy that they get out of their food. And then compare that to a unit that physicists often use called a joule. So that's a different unit of energy. But the ordering here just kind of gives you a sense of the amount of energy that these different events release. And if you kind of scroll down that list a bit, you'll see that a major geomagnetic storm on Earth. So that's about 10 to the 16th joules. So that's a number that's so big that it's basically 10 with 16 zeros after it, or 1 with 16 zeros after it. A number even bigger than our national debt, if you can imagine such a thing. And you'll see that the major geomagnetic storm is actually about the same, maybe two times more energetic than, say, a megaton H-bomb. So that kind of gives you the sense of scale of the amount of energy that the storm has. Of course, and that's energy is distributed throughout the entire magnetic field during the storm. And it's also kind of similar to, say, a magnitude 8 earthquake. So it's kind of similar amounts of energy being happening during a geomagnetic storm. You can skip down a little bit further and see that the amount of energy from a solar flare, like a big solar flare, is actually it's 10 billion times stronger than the energy of a geomagnetic storm, 10 to the 26th joules. So it's a rather enormous amount of energy. So it's more than the total amount of, it's 10 times more than the total amount of energy of sunlight that lands on Earth every year, although it's 1,000 times less than the amount of energy that the Earth has because of its spinning. So it's kind of an interesting comparison. And it's also quite a bit less energetic than, say, the highest energy thing I have on the chart, which is a exploding star, a supernova. All right, so my last slide is just a picture that depicts many of the satellites that NASA has flying to study this whole interaction of the sun with Earth. And, you know, some of the other parts of NASA have these big observatories that have been called the Great Observatories, like the Hubble Space Telescope, the Spitzer Space Telescope, and the Chandra Space Telescope. So the folks in the heliophysics part of NASA have decided that this whole suite of instruments is our great observatory that study this whole Sun-Earth connection. And it even includes now the Voyager spacecraft, who are still out there sending us useful information about the edge of the heliosphere. All right, so that wraps up my presentation, and I'm happy to answer some questions.
Oh, Brian, thank you so much. Can you hear me?
I can.
Excellent. So we'll open the lines up now for some quick questions before the end of the hour. Jerry, could you help us out with that?
Thank you. To ask a question, please press star 1. Please make sure your phone is not muted and record your name slowly and clearly when prompted. To withdraw your question, press star 2. Once again, that is star 1 for questions. One moment, please, for questions to come through.
And we got this one by email that we'll start with while that's happening. What new data really surprised you and why? Is there anything you've run into recently that's been an aha or excitement?
Well, you know, I didn't mention much about one of NASA's latest solar mission called the Space Dynamics Observatory, or SDO for short. But it's actually, I think the images that I showed, the different wavelength images back in slides slides 8 through 11, those are all pictures from the Space Dynamics Observatory, or the Solar Dynamics Observatory. And it's just amazing the level of detail that we're now getting with the sun. It's just incredible the things that we're now able to see happening we have greater time resolution as well. So we've seen some solar flares occur, and we've seen the details of the solar flares as just, it's just breathtaking. So we're really starting to understand the physics that's going on with those magnetic fields as they move around. And we're starting to understand as well the mechanism by which the corona is getting heated through the kind of, again, magnetic energy that's poking out through the photosphere into the corona.
Cool. So do we have anybody waiting to ask a question?
We do. Our first question comes from Darian O'Brien. Your line is open.
Dr. Mendez, thank you very much for your presentation. Wow, your photographs of the sun are very interesting. One of the questions that I have is, we have the Venus transit coming up, and there's been, you know, lots of things written about how when the Venus transit was originally observed back in the late 1700s, is my understanding. They were attempting to determine the astronomical unit, and from what I've read in our Night Sky Network, as well as other publications, it was actually never really determined that accurately with the measurements that were made. And I was just curious, you know, these, I get a lot of questions from people talking about the temperature of the sun, the distance from the Earth to the sun, and they always ask me, well, how do we know these things? And I would just wonder if you get that question from an audience, public audience, without telling them that they need to go and get a degree in astronomy, which I don't even know if you would find that information out if you were to go and get a degree in astronomy. Are there any public sources of information that they can go to find information? For instance, like how is the transit of Venus used to determine the actual astronomical unit, and how we know there's the number of suns or the diameter of the sun and the temperatures within the layers of the sun. Any suggestions there?
Sure, and I might ask Vivian to help me verify the URL here. So, you know, with the upcoming transit of Venus, I think the website you should check out is transitofvenus.org.
I believe that's right.
I think that's the right one. They have some wonderful activities there explaining the actual mathematics of how to do the parallax calculation to measure the distance of an
AU.
And, in fact, they have a program running to get students to hook up, I think, between Alaska and Hawaii to actually make that observation again. So that'll be really cool, and hopefully that'll all be archived. So, if someone ask you about that later after the event, you could point them to transitofvenus.org and they could actually see, you know, those same observations.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Now, I just want to mention, though, of course, that nowadays we can measure the distances in the solar system much more accurately with radar ranging. And that's what's done nowadays is we basically just bounce a radar beam, which is just a beam of radio waves, off of the moon, off of Venus and other nearby planets, and we time the amount of time it takes for the reflection wave to reach us. And it's the radar moves at the speed of light, so it's just a matter of rate equals distance times time.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
Sure.
Yeah, I think we've got time for one more question before the end of the hour.
Our next question comes from Linda Price. Your line is open. Linda Prince, I'm sorry.
Hi. Oh, first I want to say that your explanation of the sunspot cycle and the how it's related to magnetic activity on the sun clarified a lot of things for me, so that was very good. Slide 15, I had some questions on.
Sure.
The spherical shape called the terminal shock.
Uh-huh.
Same thing as the heliosphere.
Yeah, so in general, it's kind of complicated in detail, so I like to try to just generally call this whole bubble the heliosphere.
And the heliosphere is spherical, but surrounding that you've got a heliopause or a heliosheath.
Right. Yeah, I tend to actually think of everything that's inside the heliopause as the heliosphere, even though it's not totally spherical. And the reason it's not spherical is because of its motion actually through the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of think about what's happening is on the side of the direction that the sun is moving, the gas is kind of compressed, and then opposite the direction of where the sun is moving, the gas is kind of drawn out, so that's why you get that almost comet-like shape there that you're seeing in the helio sheath.
Is that why it's hitting through other, you know, interstellar gas?
That's right.
Like galaxy?
Right. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Very cool. So I wish we had time for more questions, but I think that's about it. Thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight. Thank you so much, Brian. You are always so good at explaining things, and we really enjoy having you. We hope you get our Magnetic Sun Outreach Toolkit soon in the mail, and that you get a lot of chance to use them this summer and beyond. Looks like there's a decent chance, actually, of a geomagnetic storm tonight, so keep an eye out if you're in the northern latitudes and have clear skies. You may just get a show. Happy solar viewing and happy summer, everyone. Thanks so much. Good night.
Thank you.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect your lines at this time.